the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today, we're going to have a fascinating discussion about abortion, and we're going to go back in history to a meeting in 1964 when a group of liberal Catholic theologians met with members of the Kennedy family at Hyannisport, Massachusetts, and they created for the Kennedy family an argument about how they could change their position from pro-life to pro-abortion. The author of the article in the Wall Street Journal that draws our attention to that is Ann Hendershot. We're going to have her as our guest today. She is the author of the book, The Politics of Abortion, and she's the author of the article, the Wall Street Journal, that I reference at my article, which is up at albertmohler.com, on this particularly chilling moment in history. But it's very instructive. We'll learn a lot. We'll see some things we definitely need to see. When we take a look at that meeting and come to understand what happened, it's a theological sellout. It was a meeting that literally led to the deaths of unborn babies, perhaps by the untold millions. And it's a meeting that needs to be in our view. It's a topic that is ripe for our discussion. We're going to be having Ann Hendershot as our guest in just a bit. And we're going to open the phone lines for discussion. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. The big issue is, of course, the fact that there are always, seemingly, some theologians ready to sell out their own church and to create a public argument that would allow those running for office or holding office to defy the positions of their own church while simultaneously claiming to be faithful. And on the issue of abortion, this is a big issue, but it's not just abortion. And in the case of the Kennedy family, the church is the Roman Catholic Church, but it's not just the Roman Catholic Church that's at stake here. The pattern is clear. It happens not only in this case, but in tragically too many other cases as well. We're going to be looking at this with Ann Hendershot in just a few moments. First, to review some issues in the news. Big news out concerning the inauguration. You know, in recent weeks and days, there has been a considerable controversy about the fact that President-elect Barack Obama invited Saddleback pastor Rick Warren to give the invocation at the inauguration on January the 20th. Well, the president-elect has said that he's all about balance. And at that inaugural ceremony, the opening prayer is to come from Rick Warren, who is attracting a lot of controversy because of his support for Proposition 8 and his stated belief that homosexual marriage is wrong and should not be made legal, his opposition to same-sex marriage there in California. He's being bracketed on the other side by Joseph Lowry. Interestingly, Barney Frank, the openly gay member of Congress, the first openly gay member of Congress, had come out with a statement saying that he was not placated by the fact that Joseph Lowry was giving the benediction because he said that's one-to-one, that's a tie, and I didn't work this hard for a tie. Well, it's not tied now. Two very interesting announcements. The first came in the New York Times yesterday, and that is that the president-elect has named the minister to lead the prayer service, which traditionally is held the day after the inauguration. That preacher is going to be a woman, the Reverend Sharon E. Watkins, who is president and general minister of the Christian Church. That's the Disciples of Christ. The New York Times describes that denomination this way, a small, liberal-leaning Protestant denomination with 3,754 congregations and about 690,000 members in the United States and Canada. Now, by the way, Ms. Watkins had previously been pastor of a church in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. That church, during her tenure, quote, could not reach a consensus on whether to allow gay union ceremonies and decided to hold off on a decision, end quote. Well, she is seen nonetheless as very, very friendly to the idea, and she's going to be preaching at this particular ceremony. And then just today came the announcement, and this is the big one. Let me just read to you from the release that was set out by Politico. It says this: The Right Reverend V. Gene Robinson of New Hampshire, who was elected the Episcopal Church's first openly gay bishop in 2003, will deliver the invocation for Sunday's kickoff inaugural event on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, the Presidential Inauguration Committee said today. The president-elect is scheduled to attend the afternoon event, which is free and open to the public. From the statement released by the Transition and Inaugural Committee, it says this, quote, "The president-elect has respect for the Right Reverend Robinson, who offered his advice and counsel over the past couple of years. It also has the benefit of further reinforcing our commitment to an open and inclusive inaugural." So, very interesting there. Barney Frank said he wasn't satisfied with a one-to-one tie. Well, it's 3-to-1 now in terms of the announcements that have been made. And the president-elect is reflecting here a long-term relationship he's had with Bishop Robinson in terms of a political relationship. He had been seeking his counsel during the time, of course, New Hampshire, very crucial primary in both the Republican and Democratic parties coming so early in the sequence. So there you have it. And so the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, the first openly gay bishop of the Episcopal Church, will be starting off the inaugural festivities at the Lincoln Memorial with his invocation. Folks, we are headed into some very interesting territory. We should say some potentially interesting territory. It should be interesting. The confirmation hearings for the cabinet members of the president-elect's cabinet will begin. And, of course, we had the actual beginning last week with Tom Daschle having his hearings begin for Health and Human Services Secretary. And now we have Hillary Clinton coming forward for her confirmation hearings to be the next Secretary of State. Now, there are others coming as well, the Attorney General, the Secretary of Energy, a lot being scheduled because this works through a committee process in the Senate before coming to the full Senate. But it is interesting. The Los Angeles Times says that the welcome mat is being rolled out for Hillary Clinton, that welcome mat being rolled out by members of the Republican as well as the Democratic parties. Now, let me suggest to you, there are some fascinating things going on here. Item number one, the historical fact is that now Hillary Clinton is the Secretary of State designee and nominee for the incoming administration. You rewind history a couple of years and listen to yourself being told that Hillary Clinton is not the candidate for president in the 2008 election, but instead is the nominee to be Secretary of State. That is a stunning piece of news. Here is item number two. Both parties traditionally give a great deal of deference to the president's choices, the president-elect's choices in this case, for cabinet positions. So there is a prejudice definitely toward the confirmation of one who receives the nomination, which is to say it's fairly difficult to derail a nomination. It happens, but it's fairly difficult. The third thing is that if you want to get a confirmation hearing that is likely to go well, nominate a member of the United States Senate, because there is particular deference paid by senators to each other. Now, that's not infinite. Just ask Senator John Tower back several years ago now in the Reagan and Bush administrations. But just imagine what's going on here. You have a very, very interesting thing with so many senators coming forward. And so you have Senator Salazar from Colorado who will have his own confirmation hearings. And, of course, you've got Senator Clinton. Now, one of the interesting things people are going to watch here is how Senator Kerry interrogates Senator Clinton. It's well known and is no secret that Senator Kerry had desired that position himself. Leaving politics, very interesting story in the media and marketing section of the Wall Street Journal. Now, get this. This is something I wouldn't have known if it were not covered as it is in the news. The Disney Corporation is reporting that television is losing a crucial audience. Now, get this audience. It is boys aged 6 to 14. It turns out the boys aged 6 to 14 have decided there are better things to do than watch television. And guess what they're doing? They're playing video games. There has been a shift in terms of the chosen entertainment from television to video games on the part of boys. Disney wants them back. Peter Sanders, reporting for the Wall Street Journal, says this. Next month, the company will launch a boy-focused entertainment brand called Disney XD, consisting of a new cable television channel, a comprehensive website with games, music, videos, and social networking. Now, I love one particular paragraph that is highlighted here in my article. It says this. On February 13, Disney will rebrand its existing animation channel, Toon Disney, as Disney XD. That's going to be the channel. And will launch the new action feature show, Aaron Stone. That's A-A-R-O-N, Stone. That it hopes will become the channel's centerpiece to reach boys. The show melds aspects of what the company says boys are interested in. Now get this. Action, adventure, and video games. All right, I'll admit I find that ironic. Disney says that it's losing market share. Not just Disney, but all of television is losing market share. 6 to 14-year-old boys aren't watching television. Instead of watching television, they're playing video games. So they're going to come out with a new network, which is directed to 6 to 14-year-old boys, and they're going to show, evidently, boys playing video games. Now, here's the deal. How many boys would rather play video games or watch a television program where other boys are playing video games? I don't know. It sounds like a risky strategy to me. But nonetheless, it shows you something that is good for us to know, that that the mass media here knows, and that is that there's a difference between girls and boys. And while there are psychologists and others, sociologists, educators who are trying to deny the difference, if you're trying to sell product, you know the difference. Advertisers know their demographics. If you want to know who knows, who's watching, I guarantee you, Disney knows. If you're a parent, you've got to find that interesting. We're going to be back to talk about a crucial meeting in 1964 that has lessons for us right now on the issue of abortion. We could call it a sellout. And we'll be right back to talk about it on the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Miller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. I have to tell you, in last week's Wall Street Journal in particular, in a story that I read at the very end of the week, I saw an example of the best kind of journalism. It's a story that was published, actually dated the January 1, 2009 date of the Wall Street Journal. The title of the article was How Support for Abortion Became Kennedy Dogma, and it has to do with the opening about the fact that, of course, Caroline Kennedy, who is likely perhaps to become the next Kennedy senator, that she has certainly affirmed in very unwavering terms her support for abortion. No expectation of surprise there, because after all, that's the dogma of the Democratic Party and it's the dogma of the Kennedy family. But it wasn't always so. And I knew the story in general terms, but I did not know the particulars. Ann Hendershot, who is professor of urban studies at the King's College in New York City, formerly taught at the University of San Diego, has written a fascinating book, The Politics of Abortion. And she wrote the article that I cited in my article at albertmiller.com. She wrote the article in the Wall Street Journal, and she talks about, well, some background information that I find not only fascinating but instructive, even chilling. Ann Hendershot's my guest today on the Albert Miller Program. Professor Hendershot, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Miller. I'm happy to be here.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, thank you for that article. I was just talking with another person who deals with Christian ethics this afternoon, and we were just talking about how thankful we are that you wrote and that the Wall Street Journal published that article. It's just a stellar piece.
Oh, well, I'm grateful you posted it on your blog, and I appreciated what you said about it, because the warning that you kind of give to other theologians is a warning that I wish more Catholic theologians and Protestant Catholic theologians should take to heart, because they can be very powerful, and that's what the piece is about, how Catholic priests and theologians really convinced the Kennedys that they could support abortion with a clear conscience.
Now, in your book, The Politics of Abortion, you have a more extended explanation of this. I'm reading from page 10 here, and I just want to set it up for you to explain it. You write, in a long-forgotten meeting at the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport, on a hot summer day in 1964, the Kennedy family and their advisors and allies were coached by leading theologians and Catholic college professors to accept and promote abortion with, quote, a clear conscience, end quote. How did that happen, and what happened in that meeting?
Well, we know all about it. We know the particulars because a former Jesuit priest by the name of Albert Johnson wrote a book and just in 1998, and it was called The Birth of Bioethics. He kind of thinks of himself as the father of bioethics, and he was really bragging about it. And I don't know that the Kennedys were so happy with him doing that, but he really felt like a very powerful man because he was called to the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport and brags about how he was sitting on the oceanside terrace of Bobby Kennedy's home in Hyannisport, convincing him that he could support abortion. But Bobby Kennedy was part of the conspiracy because he wanted to run for senator in New York. And in 1964, abortion was a hot topic in New York. It was legalized in New York way before Roe v. Wade. So Bobby Kennedy wanted to run for senator, and he wanted to have some theological cover, is what I call it. It's hard for me to say this because I love the Catholic Church. They've had some wonderful people, but they made a very big mistake in the 60s, and there were a number of Jesuits at that meeting, most of them college professors, who convinced him that, well, they took the argument from John Courtney, Father John Courtney Murray's position that said that, you know, this separation of church and state, that in order to get along, that it would, if you repress this new law, it could lead to greater perils in social peace and justice. So they took the social justice tack that women would die from illegal abortion, so we have to provide this.
You know, I've read John Courtney Murray. I haven't read everything, but I've read all of his major works. And frankly, I disagree with the direction he takes. I'm not a Catholic, so this is not an intramural discussion. But quite frankly, it explained to me how John F. Kennedy could take the approach he took in 1960, speaking to the Houston Baptist Pastors Association.
Isn't that a disaster?
But it seems to me that that's where you have the divergence, where you come up with the idea that, yes, I'm a believer, but I don't have to apply those convictions to my public life. Once you get there, then it's pretty easy, in one sense, to get to what happened in 1964. But what's chilling to me is how there were so many willing theological accomplices here. And some of these names, these names are well known to me. Robert Drynan, who later became a congressman until the Pope required all Catholics to leave elective office. He was followed, by the way, by his chosen successor, Barney Frank, there in Massachusetts.
Oh, yes, I know, because I think Barney Frank's brother or something worked in Drynan's office.
Yeah, it's a really convoluted thing.
Drynan was one of the most pro-abortion senators from Massachusetts, even before Roe v. Wade, and he supported every form of abortion, including partial birth abortion. Yeah, it's an embarrassment for the Catholic Church, I think. But, I mean, we still have these problems today because there are still a number of Catholics who believe that you can still be a good Catholic and support abortion. I mean, even Nancy Pelosi said that she thinks it's kind of geographical, as if God's word changes by geography. But that's pretty much what she was saying.
Well, but she also managed to stick her foot in her mouth theologically by accusing Augustine of believing something he never believed or taught and completely misconstruing the moral history of abortion in her own church. But, you know, the lessons here certainly are directed towards an event that that concerned Catholics. And one of them, for instance, Charles Curran, who was removed from his position at the Catholic University of America because of his teachings that violated the magisterial authority of the church, and in particular on the question of abortion as well as papal authority. But as an evangelical, I have to tell you, Professor Hendershot, this is really close to home because this is what happens when theologians become accomplices to the sellout of their own faith. And unfortunately, that happens in more cases than we would ever like to imagine. It happens. Mainline Protestantism was basically taken into a liberal trajectory by its theologians. It wasn't the people. In fact, the people in the pews of those churches even now are far more conservative than those who are teaching in their seminaries. And so, to me, it just seems that this particular meeting really underlines in a very graphic way what's at stake, because I don't think it's too much of an argument to say that meeting led, in terms of a direct line of the Kennedy family participation, to the death of unborn human beings.
Oh, I think it's had long. I think you're right, absolutely right, Dr. Mueller. And that's the saddest part of all, that really the Catholic clergy we can thank for bringing us abortion on demand in large part. And that's horrible to have to say that. But, I mean, it continues in other denominations, but they've really played a role, an important role. Senator Ted Kennedy was himself pro-life, or at least he said he was pro-life, even into the 70s. 1971, he was still, there's a letter I have posted on the Internet where he wrote a constituent saying how he respects life from the moment of conception. That's 1971. He didn't have to be pro-choice because he was not in New York. His brother had to be pro-choice because he was in New York. But Massachusetts people, like you said, the people in the pews, were still very strongly, strongly pro-life. And so he didn't want to be pro-choice because he wouldn't have been reelected.
Well, I mentioned in my article the names Al Gore and Jesse Jackson, just as who are neither of whom is Catholic. Al Gore being a Baptist and Jesse Jackson being a Baptist as well in a different denomination. Both of them were once solidly pro-life. Al Gore ran for the Congress and the Senate from Tennessee as a solid pro-life supporter. Jesse Jackson once went so far as to write an article published, I believe, in Sojourner's Magazine, in which he argued that one of the signs of racism in America was the annihilation of unborn black babies and the scourge of abortion. But when both of them decided to run for president, they changed their position. And clearly, even by their own admission, it was no coincidence. When we come back, I'm going to ask Professor Ann Hendershot to talk about another link, and that is when feminism became pro-abortion. That's a story you need to hear as well. We'll be right back on the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Ann Hendershot, Professor of Urban Studies at the King's College in Manhattan, a fascinating college, meets in the Empire State Building. Fascinating outpost there for evangelical scholarship, and very proud that it's there. Proud to have Ann Hendershot on the program today. She's the author of an outstanding book entitled The Politics of Abortion. And Professor Hendershot, you know, this is a story that I think I know pretty well, but I have to tell you, you added some material and some background that I found absolutely fascinating to my knowledge of some of the connections here. One of the things you demonstrate in your book is what I'd like to ask you about right now, and that is, you make the very clear case that feminism was not tied to the abortion rights movement until political expediency brought the two together. Can you tell us that story?
That's true. I mean, the earliest feminists, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, were very much pro-life, and they found they thought that those were the very earliest. But even Betty Friedan in the 60s, the Feminine Mystique, which is really the Bible of feminists, not a word really about abortion. It was not an issue. But there was money to be made in the abortion industry. Two men, Larry Leder and Bernard Nathanson. Nathanson later recanted and had a conversion experience and now has Jesus in his life. So he has told us really what happened in these early days. He regrets his role in bringing abortion to the masses, but he said he had to really convince feminists to jump on board. And to do that, because he knew that that would help increase the industry. There was money to be made, so there was money there. So the politicians and the moneymakers were on board before the feminists were. But once that snowball got started and women jumped aboard, there was no stopping it. And now, I mean, you kind of equate feminism with that, which is too bad because we have Feminists for Life, a really terrific organization who says abortion, their slogan is abortion hurts women. They look at the role, you know, certainly they worry about the unborn child, but they worry about women and the after effects of abortion. But no, feminists were not part of this in the beginning, not at all.
Now, what do you think was the motivation? You mentioned money, but tie that together so that folks can understand. In what sense did the feminist movement gain by jumping upon the abortion rights bandwagon?
Well, they were convinced that in order for women to play a full role in the workforce, sort of like the Soviet ideology or the Marxist ideology, that for women needed to be released from their childbearing responsibilities. And then that goes pretty much back to Margaret Sanger days, and then we get into race issues. But they were convinced that it would be good for women to be released from these kinds of responsibilities. And birth control opened the door for that, to be able to choose, you know, when to have a child. And then once that door was opened, women jumped aboard. And they had plenty of help. You had these groups, once again, Catholic group. I wouldn't call them Catholic, but Catholics for a Free Choice, which sees itself under the leadership then of Frances Kissling, who really saw herself as a feminist, but also had such hatred for the Catholic Church that she even said she wanted to overthrow the Church. So that you have this intertwining between the Democratic Party, the Church, and the people who hate religion and hate the Church, and women who become convinced that in order for women to play a full role in the workforce, they need to have this access to abortion.
Yeah, you know, I've read so many of the feminists on this, and one of the points they make is that men are not constrained biologically in terms of their career path and career options,
right,
because they don't get pregnant. So in order to be equal, a woman has to have the ability to eliminate the, quote, threat of a pregnancy to her career. You know, I just find that to be such tragic language, but it is clear that when you look
you should be the writer here, Dr. Mueller. That's exactly what I would have liked to have said. That's a terrific way to put it. That's exactly what it was about.
Well, I got to tell you, I just hope more people would read your book. And the book, again, is entitled The Politics of Abortion. The author's Ann Hendershot at King's College, the King's College there in New York City. Professor Hendershot, thank you so much for joining us today on the program.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Mueller.
And I'm, by the way, looking forward to her new book, which I've just seen announced, on how Catholic education has decided to go after the adulation of the world. Because, unfortunately, once again, the evangelical parallels are all too apparent. We'll be back to take your calls on the Albert Mueller program. I'd like to know what you are thinking about when you hear the story, the recounting there of that meeting, and you think about the danger of having your church's teachings sold out by those who would give politicians political cover. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Give me a call on the Albert Mueller program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, history is fascinating just in terms of the record of what happened and the interpretation of those events, because there's always a mixture of interpretation while you understand the facts. But it is also true that the historical distance gives you a little bit of perspective that you don't have at the moment. I'm not sure that people who observed that meeting at Hyannisport in Massachusetts in 1964 would have understood the full import of what was happening. But in retrospect, we sure can now. And what you had there was a graphic depiction of what happens when theologians and priests or pastors sell out their own church in order to create political cover for politicians. The issue of abortion is probably the clearest example, but it's not the only example. We have it now on homosexuality and any number of other issues. And the argument that's being used there all the way back to 1964 was this. Look, the separation of church and state means that you have a private conviction and a public responsibility, and they do not have to be tied together. In other words, you can say, as for instance, former New York Governor Mario Cuomo said in a very infamous address given at the University of Notre Dame in 1984, he said, I am personally pro-life, but as governor, I defend abortion rights. And so you say, well, that looks like a gross disconnect, and that would be because you have common sense. But when you start using this argument that there are private convictions and then there are public responsibilities and the two do not have to be consistent, then you can go in any number of directions you want. You can say, I believe that homosexuality is a sin. However, I am going to support the right of persons to marry someone of the same sex. And so you have that. So on the issue of abortion, the issue, of course, is life. And so a lot of people would think that where the argument began that would convince people to go from pro-life to pro-choice in orientation and in voting, a lot of people would think that the argument would, first of all, have centered on, for instance, whether or not the fetus is genuinely human. And, you know, one thing I find fascinating is that that is not where that argument began, because just as abortion itself wasn't even controversial or talked about before, say, the early 1960s, even in that discussion, the moral and ontological status, that is to say, the actual status of being of the fetus as human, was not in question. That was recognized. Only later, in terms of the kind of rethink that would take place, did people try to come up with these arguments. And by the way, we now know what we did not know at the time, and that is when Harry Blackmun, the Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, in 1973 wrote the majority opinion in the decision Roe v. Wade, he already knew where he wanted the decision to go. He was, after he made that judgment, looking for a rationale to put in his opinion, his decision. And that is just not intellectually honest. By the way, we know that not only because of his law clerks and others, we now know it because of his own daughter, Susan Blackman, who is herself an abortion rights activist, who recounted how her father brought that conversation home to the dinner table and let the process be known. Now, Ann Hendershot, whose article in the Wall Street Journal first caught my attention and whose book, The Politics of Abortion, I think is must reading, she recounts that article in 1964. And one of the points that she makes there is that, of course, you had collusion going on. You had those who were the official teachers of the Catholic Church present in that meeting in order to enable a political family with at least two persons there headed for the Senate, one, Senator Edward Kennedy, already in the Senate since 1962, and Robert F. Kennedy, running for the Senate from New York in 1964. So you had a family here that wanted to change its position. They wanted to find a way where they would not alienate their Roman Catholic base. They would not repudiate openly the teaching of their church in such a way that the church would take punitive action, but that they would make this bifurcation, this separation between their private convictions and public responsibilities. Now, at my article posted at albertmuller.com, I said there are two huge lessons here, and I want to look at those lessons very closely. Number one, the first lesson is, there seemed to be no shortage of theologians who will sell out their church. I put it this way. I said this. There will be theologians who seem ever ready to find a way to subvert the teachings of their church, even as they seek to remain in its employ and trust. Now, again, that is not a Catholic problem. That's a far larger problem. That's true in mainstream, what's called mainline Protestantism. That's how those denominations began to go so liberal now decades ago and are now at their elites, at the level of their leadership and seminary professors and college leadership and all the rest are thoroughly liberal. That's where it began. But among evangelicals, we have the same pattern that can be discerned and to the same effect. It's a sellout. And the second lesson is this. There will ever be politicians who are looking for political cover and will gladly receive this cover from those willing to subvert their church's teachings. Now, in this case, it was the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. The issue was abortion, and the family was Kennedy. But the reality is that there are far more denominations involved than just that, and there are countless politicians who are trying to hold to this kind of position. One of the things that I said earlier in this program is that this didn't begin in 1964 when presidential candidate John F. Kennedy spoke to the meeting of the Houston Baptist Pastors Conference. It was an associational meeting there in Houston in 1960. He said, in response to what many people were accusing him of believing as a Catholic, that even as he was a Catholic, he would not bring his Catholic convictions into the role that he would play as president. And, of course, what I wish is that on the issue of abortion, Catholic candidates held to the position of their church and defended human life, because I can find no way that I could possibly decide that on the one hand, and here's the real horror of this, let's look at what we're talking about. On the one hand, you believe that abortion is murder, and on the other hand, you believe that it has to be protected as a right? In what sane mind can murder be defined as a right? In what sane and consistent and honest mind can you say, I believe that abortion is the unwarranted, murderous, homicidal taking of an innocent human life that should have the same moral standing as any other human life? And then say, but in my public role, my public office, I'm going to support the platform of my party, and I am going to fight for and defend the right to kill unborn babies. This lesson, or these lessons, are so instructive, and when we look at this, we realize that it's not just the issue of abortion, and it's certainly not just the Roman Catholic Church. This is a process that goes on before our eyes. If we just look closely enough, we'll see the pattern. Ann Hendershot, in her article and in her book, takes us to a meeting in 1964 where, in retrospect, we now get to hear participants say what happened. I find the knowledge of that meeting absolutely chilling, but also clarifying. Back with final thoughts. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. One of the things that we face again and again is when we see changes in the society and changes in morality and changes in the culture that require some explanation. And it is our task as thinking Christians to look at these things and try to connect the dots, try to figure all of this out, because they do not happen by accident. And especially when you see organized shifts in moral behavior, something significant is going on there, and we need to be looking carefully at what's going on. Almost always, you're going to find that there is a pattern of a coalescence of persons who have similar, if not identical, purposes to bring about this change. And if you go back and start to look at the worldviews that are represented there, you'll often see that, of course, it's never just about that issue. Now, I'm saying this because if you go back to 1964 and you look at that meeting we've been discussing between liberal Catholic priests and theologians and then the Kennedy family that led to the change in the Kennedy family's position on abortion, you know, it's never just abortion. It's never just one thing. Once you accept that you can make this divide between private conviction and public office, then you can apply it, and frankly, you will apply it whenever it's convenient to whatever moral principle or conviction or church teaching that is at stake. Now, looking at this, I think we find a very sober realization. That sober realization is this. If people in the pews of churches allow this to happen, then ultimately they become co-conspirators in this process. If we in the society simply go along with the kind of redefinition and revolution that is being talked about here that we can trace to a meeting like this and that we can see in the larger changes in the society in terms of conviction, then we are a part of the problem, not of the solution. You see, here's a bit of good news. If you go back to 1964 and you look forward and now look to 1995 and then onward to the year 2008, you're going to be surprised that the majority of presidents elected, say, between 1968 and the present, have been those with pro-life convictions. You see, one of the things you will be able to detect is that the American people have not moved in lockstep with those who've tried to bring about this moral revolution. To the contrary, a good number of Americans have enough moral sense to know that if you compromise the dignity and the sanctity of life of an unborn human being, it isn't long before you necessarily discount the right to life of every single human person on the planet. So there's hope. There's hope that something like this can be confronted and analyzed, and eventually we have the hope that we can reach the hearts of the American people to recover moral sanity and the sanctity of human life, and to expect that of those who would lead them. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.